were to inri interest of Neri and inri interest of Esperanza. And it looks like Mr. Reeves.
I guess, Your Honor, that actually, we were just kind of talking about that. It might take some minor clarification.
Mr. Boyle.
I'm Mr. Boyle. On 629, obviously there's a quasi-companion case, 662. We weren't clear how the court maybe was going to want to split the time on that. If it's all there for the purpose of the briefing, but if for the purpose of argument, it was going to be separately argued or how it was intended to proceed.
Okay, so Mr. Boyle, you're in 629, excuse me, 629, the
yes,
Neri case, and Ms. Reeves, you're in Esperanza?
Both cases.
Both cases.
Right.
And Mr. Judge, you've got them all, right?
I'm
okay.
That's correct.
Right. So what are you proposing with respect to division of time?
Well, frankly, Your Honor, my request is that I have my own separate 10 minutes because there are issues, as the court is aware, in 662 that don't necessarily pertain to my client or my appeal, that I felt which I don't want any of my time for argument because there are a few issues that I would like to address.
Okay, so you want your own 10.
Yes, sir.
And Ms. Reeves, do you want your own 10 too?
Yes, Your Honor.
I guess that was a leading question, wasn't it? Mr. Judge, what's your view on this?
I do not object, Your Honor, to both of them receiving their time. However, I would request that I be allowed to respond at the end of both of their arguments in chief so that I don't have to go back and twice.
Okay.
It would be my own position. I think, really, they're talking about primarily same issues with respect to everything except perhaps the preliminary motions.
Okay. Let me consult with my colleagues here for a second.
This is why you've been paid the big bucks over all these years.
That sounds fine to me.
Okay. What we're going to do is we're going to give you each 8 minutes. These are really good things to file by motion. Might put that in. And Mr. Judds, with that, how much time would you like?
I still think 10 minutes will be
okay,
sufficient.
But you want to go last.
I would appreciate it, I guess.
All right, we'll do that. All right, who's going to go first?
I believe I've been nominated to go first.
All right, Mr. Boyle. Okay.
May it please the court, counsel, thank you for allowing me to appear today on this matter. Appreciate you considering our initial questions here. I've got a lot of the argument laid out in my brief, and I think most of it is there, but there are a couple of issues I wanted to hit specifically out. And first and foremost, I want to draw attention to what I believe is a plain error on the record. It ties into the first assigned error and the major argument that was raised both before the actual hearings occurred and in brief here and was argued pretty strenuously, and that's in regards to the motion to terminate parental rights having been insufficiently pled. The plain error is basically that the petition was also insufficiently pled. It's clear from the case law, the citations are in the brief, specifically in race Sabrina B, I believe, is specifically on point that equal language is necessary to be pled. There are completely distinct and separate elements to be proven in a motion to terminate under ICWA. And for that reason, you can't simply proceed under ordinary language for termination and then later on adopt and say, well, it works for ICWA too because you had enough evidence to support that. You actually have to plead it. And to that end, the In Re Dakota L case speaks to that in regard to the petition. Now, a lot of the discussion and obviously the language in the brief and even at hearing was pertinent to the motion to terminate parental rights, although the insufficiency of pleading wasn't just on the motion to terminate parental rights. It was also on the petition. The petition itself did not allege anything having to do with ICWA. Now, the natural response to that on the state side is that it had already been filed, the children had already been removed, and to some degree, that's not an invalid argument, that you don't. For instance, if you have a petition filed, you have an adjudication, and you go into termination, and you find out that ICWA actually is relevant to the case, you don't go back and file a new petition and have a new adjudication, because what's done is done, and you have the evidence you had at the time that the adjudication went in. But in this case, we didn't have an adjudication. In this case, the adjudication didn't occur until after it was admitted on the record, at the very latest possible point that ICWA could have applied in the benefit of the state is prior to us having any hearing on the motion to terminate parental rights or on the petition itself. We didn't have an adjudication on the petition. Therefore, the original petition was invalid as soon as it was determined that ICWA applies, and ICWA applied before the adjudication came to be. I think In Re Dakota L is specifically on point on that. And in the same way that In Re Sabrina B is specifically on point on the motion to terminate parental rights. So for both, on both, essentially, pleadings that are relevant to this matter, they were simply insufficiently pled. The state should not have been permitted to proceed on the grounds that there was insufficient pleadings.
So what would have been the court's reaction at that time to have everything start over?
Well, first and foremost, I think the court absolutely should not have waited 10 months until after we had, you know, 6 days of hearing spread out over 10 months to make a ruling on the motion. You know, if the court felt that was something that needed to be determined, I think the court could have taken that under advisement and reconvened it at that point so we don't have the mess that we have now. But yes, essentially, you start over. You say, okay, well, we now know ICWA applies. These pleadings are insufficient. Refile sufficient pleadings. And there's case law that suggests exactly that. That, well, when you know that ICWA applies, and if you've got pleadings that don't contain the necessary language, there's nothing wrong with going back, refiling, and doing things right from there. But the issue is, and getting again into the second assignment of error, is that you can't change horses midstream. I mean, halfway through the proceedings, now all of a sudden we're in an ICWA case. We've got the new filings, but the elements are different.
Before you get too far into
that,
what about the doctrine generally that it's permissible to amend the pleadings to conform to the proof?
Absolutely. That is, and that's something actually that the state considered and specifically mentioned in the argument, that, well, we can simply conform our pleadings to the evidence. That's actually something that was specifically addressed. I mean, not specifically addressed, but addressed, an issue was addressed in Dakota L. There was a petition filed, an original petition, that didn't have ICWA language. And there was a subsequent ICWA petition that did have the necessary language. They proceeded on the original petition, and it submitted all the necessary evidence that would satisfy the ICWA pleadings, but the court still said, that doesn't matter. It wasn't in the pleadings. It has to be in the pleadings. So conforming the pleadings to the evidence works if you don't have substantial changes to the elements to be made. And there are, it's clear there are substantial differences between ICWA pleadings and non-ICWA pleadings. And so to change that, it's not simply saying, well, we were proceeding under 292.2 and now we're proceeding under, you know, 292.6 or whatever. They're all in the same statute and generally the evidence is all brought together. This isn't that case.
So an Indian Child Welfare Act case, if you go from a regular juvenile case to an Indian child, then the burden of proof changes, right?
Absolutely.
Is that fundamentally a due process issue?
Frankly, it's my belief that it is a due process issue.
Is it due process or jurisdictional? Jurisdictional.
Well, the pleadings issue is jurisdictional. I think allowing allowing the pleadings to be changed midstream is a due process issue because they're not arraigned on those. They were never arraigned on those. They were never, you know, the rights and stuff weren't explained. And furthermore, if we get into it, the notice was insufficient and the statutory guidelines for filing notice were insufficient. So,
before you, I guess I'm going to take you up to the red light, but comment on the notice issue to the tribe?
Yes. That actually is, I mean, we're getting some of the technical legal aspects, but that's what we're here to do.
exactly.
You know, it's the notice, there was notice that something was provided. That's basically what this boils down to. The statutes require that proper notice be provided to the tribes in NICWA cases. And the statutes don't necessarily say what proper notice is, but the case law is clear and the intentions of the legislature are clear that you, if you look to what the guidelines are and the guidelines for the Bureau of Indian Affairs tell you that what you should do is you should demonstrate that they received it by filing the return receipt, which is what they did. But you should also file copies of what was actually sent, because we don't know what was sent and what was received without actually seeing a copy of what was done. And all that was filed was we sent them something and they signed for it and that's it. That is a legally insufficient notice for the tribe to proceed under the Second Amendment motion to terminate parental rights.
What was the status of the tribe in this case? Did they ultimately intervene?
The tribe filed their notice of intervention. They were granted the right to intervene. They didn't participate in any of the proceedings beyond that, but obviously reserved their right to stay apprised, and I believe some of the case law speaks to that being sufficient. All right, see, my time's up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Reeves?
I'm down to six now. Am I still at eight?
No, you have eight. Okay. And when the yellow light comes on, you've got two left.
Thank you, Your Honor. As was noted, there are two cases that I am involved with. The one that I want to talk mostly about is the older case, In re Esperanza and Mario, because my client, in one of the pretrial motions, well, it wasn't even a pretrial motion, she withdrew her earlier relinquishment of her parental rights. That was actually set out by the court as a motion, although the statutes don't indicate that that's a motion. It just says that she has an absolute right to withdraw any relinquishment. And
is there a time limit on that? I mean, doesn't it have to be contemporaneous or something to that effect?
Not with an Indian child welfare case. Now, at the time she relinquished the parental rights, ICWA did not apply in the case. Well, like I say, ICWA did not apply at that time. She was not enrolled in any tribe. However,
And the children, as I understand it, were not eligible at that time. To be enrolled.
And that's correct. The problem is the relinquishment was signed and stuffed into the case files at the Department of Health and Human Services. At no time was there even an acceptance of the relinquishment, which is my understanding under HHS guidelines, that is what validates a relinquishment, is when they accept the relinquishment.
Is it more accurate to say that at least in the record that was created and is before us, that there isn't evidence of an acceptance by the department?
There is no evidence, as a matter of fact.
So where we are is, we don't know whether there was an acceptance or not, but in our record, there isn't one.
When I requested the transcript index, I requested specifically in both cases the acceptance of relinquishment, and the response is not filed in the case.
And is the effect of it not having been accepted by the department, does that mean that there never was a relinquishment?
That means that there was not a recognizable relinquishment. By their standards, in their books, it says it's valid when accepted. So I'm saying it wasn't valid. Then, once ICWA did apply, the statutes are very clear that the mother can withdraw any relinquishment at any time for any reason. The cutoff would be once the relinquishment, or once the child is adopted, or it's accepted by the court, and there's very specific procedure for acceptance of a relinquishment by the court. So even once the court knew that the mother had withdrawn her relinquishment, and again, the court felt that it was up to them to rule on that, and I see nothing in the statutes that said this is a motion. However, it was turned into a pretrial motion and then later denied based on the fact that ICWA didn't apply at the time she relinquished. But I'm still arguing that there was never really a valid relinquishment based on the fact that it was never accepted by HHS. It was never brought to the court. And therefore, her withdrawal should have been valid once ICWA was applied.
But what's your view of what would be a proper acceptance? Is that a document?
There's a document that the Department of Health and Human Services files and fills out that says we accept the relinquishment of these children.
And where did they file that to make it a valid acceptance?
That would normally be kept in the file with their documentation of the relinquishment itself.
Kept in the department's file?
Kept in the department's file.
Okay, and so when you talked about the precipice that you filed and asked for an acceptance, you're asking for what's in the court's file, not right?
That's correct. I was asking for what was filed with the court. However, this was done as a pretrial motion, and the trial lasted from August through the beginning of the next year. At any time, if they had had proof or if they had had an acceptance, they could have brought it over to the court at any time.
So the pretrial motion was filed with some document being served on DHHS, is that correct?
The pretrial motions, the intent, originally we filed an intent of the mother to withdraw her relinquishment, and then the actual withdrawal of the relinquishment. And like I said, as far as the statutes, that's where we have to go. The court itself turned it into a pretrial motion. So having it as a pretrial motion, it was argued in the courtroom. And
so when it was argued in the courtroom, was the subject of the lack of an acceptance brought to the trial court's attention in
yes,
any
it
way?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
And what, if anything, was the state's response?
There was never an offer of proof of an acceptance.
There wasn't like, give me 5 days and I'll go get it?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Beyond that, Your Honors, this is an ICWA case, and there's not a lot of law on the ICWA cases or the NICWA cases. So as far as active efforts versus reasonable efforts, this court almost came up with a ruling at one time, but that got kicked out because apparently there was, in the Jamal case, it was filed not appropriately. So I think, you know, there's a lot of issues
before you run out of time, let me ask you, let's assume that we throw in with you, what do we say at the end of the opinion as to what happens now?
As to the withdrawal of relinquishment?
The whole shooting match, what do we What do we say happens?
Actually, we're hoping, what I'm hoping for is some direction, more clarification on ICWA and how it's to be applied in the courtroom. I think there's a huge lack of direction.
But do we send it all back to start over again? Is that we remand for a whole new set of proceedings?
I'd like to have the whole thing overturned, but naturally.
If we did that, is there anything that prevents the department from refiling?
Not a thing. And I'm certain they would.
Okay. I think you're into the red light.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Judds.
May it please the court. My name is Jay Judds. I'm the attorney for Appalese Council. Your Honors, I'd like to pick up right where Ms. Reeves left off regarding the relinquishment issue. That was in a prior case, JV06-470, I believe, involving the same mother and two of the three children who have now been terminated on. With regards to the relinquishment issue, Your Honor, I believe N. Ray Kenton H. and there's another case that involves ICWA and the burden. And the burden on anyone alleging ICWA is they have to bring forth the evidence that ICWA applies. Ida, the mother in this case, did not provide any evidence to the court that ICWA as it was at issue until August of 2011, the first day of the scheduled termination trial, when these were argued, these pretrial motions, as Ms. Reeves has said. And I would disagree with her that there isn't any evidence of acceptance, because in the transcript, page 10, in that particular case, JV06-470, there's a document submitted by Ida's previous attorney, Dorothy Benton, that actually moves the court for leave to withdraw because her client's relinquishments have been accepted by DHHS. Now, DHHS does not always...
Can I stop you there? First of all, you agree, don't you, that this is an ICWA case?
I do, Your Honor.
Okay.
From the time, prospectively forward, from the time the children were established as Indian children on the record, prior to August of 2011, those children were not established as Indian children on the record, which clearly is what N. Ray Kenton H. says.
Okay.
So
you were talking about what a previous counsel for the mother did?
Right. She filed a document, a motion for leave to withdraw, and cites in her motion the reason for withdrawing is that the relinquishments by her client as to those two children, Mario Jr. and Esperanza, were accepted by the department.
Is there a document then attached to that?
Not that I'm aware of, and not in the record.
So other than that reference, there's
no evidence in the record.
There is no other document that says DHHS accepted the relinquishment.
That's correct, Your Honor. No evidence of that in the record. My understanding of DHHS's policy is they send a letter of acceptance to the parent, not to the court. They don't normally file anything with the court.
Is there evidence of that policy or procedure in our record?
No, Your Honor, there is not. Quickly moving.
So the best we can do is say that a former lawyer in her motion to withdraw said it had been accepted, and therefore that's sufficient evidence?
Well, as an officer of the court in an official filing with the court, I believe that would certainly have some standing, Your Honor. It's not just an obscure document. It's an officer of the court filing a motion for leave to withdraw and giving the reason therefore.
Are you disputing that there is in fact a form used by DHHS that goes into the file once they accept?
I'm not disputing that, Your Honor.
Okay. Right.
With regard to notice, if I may, I'd like to move on just to address that. And the pleadings, the sufficiency of the pleadings, there were actually three petitions filed in this matter. One back in December of 2010, shortly after the children were removed. There was a second, there was an amended petition filed in approximately September of 2011. Between the time of the first 2 days of the termination trial and the next 2 days of the termination trial. And then there was a second amended petition that was filed in October of 2011, and that is what was given notice to the tribe in approximately January of 2011. With regard to notice, the tribe had ample notice, Your Honors. There's testimony throughout the record from the caseworker as well as the expert who was called to testify regarding active efforts and whether or not serious emotional and physical harm would result to these children if they were allowed to continue to live with their parents. That Ms. Shirley Badwound, who was identified as the ICWA specialist for the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, that she was involved with this case almost from the beginning. And obviously in the record, there's their notice of request to intervene. There's an acknowledgement by the trial court judge that they are allowed to intervene. That occurred back in February of 2011. So now to claim that we didn't meet the notice requirements of the statutes as it pertains to ICWA, I think, is disingenuous.
So you're saying actual notice trumps any statutory requirement?
Well, I believe actually, I don't know if it trumps, Your Honor, but certainly it has great bearing on whether or not the statute requirements were met.
What does the statute require with respect to notice?
It does require notice to be given to the tribe in order to allow them to intervene should they so desire and to be involved in the proceedings. That notice is supposed to be by certified mail and or registered mail. The very first notice to the tribe went out in November of 2010 or December of 2010, as testified to by Christina Ledesma. Those would be exhibits 22 through 27. And those were actual copies of the letters that went out to the tribe as well as the same letters that went out to Ida and Mario. That's what Christina Ledesma, the caseworker, testified to. Now, they may have been referred to by my mistake in my questioning as exhibits 15 through 20. And I think you'll notice if you look at the actual exhibits 22 through 27, it appears like there's been a whiteout of a previous exhibit number and then a new exhibit number written in over the top of that. So I believe they're exhibit 22 through 27. Exhibit 29 also is a notice that was sent to the tribe in January of 2012 and received January 11th. Now the last day of trial in this was January 31st, 2012. So certainly by that time the tribe had had 20 days notice. The statute requires 10 days notice. Neither counsel for either parent requested a continuance. Neither counsel for either parent objected to the filing of the second amended petition. So obviously they had notice. They knew what elements were going to be offered at trial. The expert testimony from Ms. Sherry Eveleth, who is a qualified expert, I believe she's testified in at least four states as a qualified ICWA expert, and she's also been qualified by numerous tribal courts to practice in their courts. And she testified regarding the active efforts in this case. She testified to the fact that serious emotional and physical harm would most likely occur. And quickly, Your Honors, I would just respectfully remind Judge Severs that this particular mother in this case was involved in a case before this court back in 2005. You were present on the panel, and you terminated her rights to a previous child, Giovanni, and that opinion was issued in May of 2005. And it was apparent from the testimony throughout 6 days of trial that this mother has not changed her ways. She's still a meth user. She still represents a severe risk to these children. The evidence also shows that the father in this case was quite aware of those facts and failed to protect these children from that mother. He was, he fathered their youngest child, Mario, while the case with Giovanni was still going on. So he was involved with that mother, Ida, while that case was going through termination trial and then up on appeal and being upheld on appeal. So it's apparent from the record that both of these parents pose serious risk to these children, and I would respectfully request this court to uphold the trial court's ruling in all respects. And I do believe the judge lays out clearly that the appropriate burdens of proof, whether it be beyond a reasonable doubt for the ICWA matters and clear and convincing evidence for the other, was met. And I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, I think everybody's used their allotted time. Thank you, all three of you, for coming. The case is submitted and the counsel's excused. And we're adjourned until tomorrow.
Thank you.